Now, Maimonides in his law book, chapter, the laws of the study of Torah, chapter 3, law number 6, okay? And basically he says like this, he who desires to fulfill the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, of study of Torah correctly, and he wants the crown of Torah, he should never separate his mind. He should not let his mind wander to other things, and he should know that he can't acquire Torah through, and he should not acquire Torah for wealth or for honor, right? And now he says, this is the way of Torah. What's the way of Torah? You should eat, he quotes a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, that you should eat bread and salt, and you should drink water, not Coke or Pepsi, and you should sleep on the ground, that means out of your beds, and a life of pain you should live, okay? And Torah you should work, you should toil, okay? So the we said the last time, we one time discussed this before, and we said that basically there are, nobody person can't live on this level, and we had different, I remember we brought different proofs, I think, for it, but we basically said that that's what you should strive for, but you must live according to your level, okay? According to your level, and so therefore you should have an outlet in the physical world based on your needs, and this is a level for the future, okay? That's what we said. What I would like to say, the truth is that every human being must live exactly how the Rambam said. And I'd like to explain how by discussing vacation for the person that is involved in the life of Torah. What is a vacation for him? Okay? We'll start with that. All right. Now, the thing is that... whenever you make a decision, you have to do two things. First of all, you have to evaluate your capabilities. And two, you have to make sure that your mind is making the decision and not your emotions. Okay? Because sometimes the emotions could be into fear. Okay? So, in fact, there's duty in the duties of the heart. Bachian Bakuda writes that when he wanted to write the book, he felt that he was not prepared because, like, his language was not well, and he doesn't have the right to embarrass himself by writing, you know, in a bad language. Then he says, maybe it's just an excuse, and it's really I'm lazy, I don't want to get involved with it. So he wasn't sure the argument was a real argument, it was just a means for laziness, okay? Right, now, but the thing is that besides laziness, there's the other side where it's the conscience making the decision. Sometimes if a person becomes too religious, and sometimes the person becomes too lazy, okay? So you got to be careful which emotion is working when you're making the decision. Okay. Now, there's one attitude in the in that we have in the United States that basically we're raised with, and that is we go to school or we go to work, and we work during the year, and then we have a vacation, whether 2 weeks or a month. That's our, that's my rights. That's my rights to this vacation time, and if I'm totally free, I'm going to do whatever I want. That is not what the Rambam is talking about. The Rambam is saying that there is no such thing as vacation time per se. There's only what your needs are that will allow you to learn at 100%. And therefore, a very careful analysis, you must be very exact to figure out exactly your needs. Because if you take more vacation time than you should, then you're lazy. It's the laziness that's making the decision. If you take less time, then your conscience is telling you to push it more than you can. So you have to make a very careful evaluation. Okay? Now, the Rambam says that whenever you're in doubt, since we always have two parts to the emotions. There's the conscience, and there is the animalistic part of you. In this case, the laziness is the animalistic part, and going to the other stream is the conscience. So Rambam says you should move a little bit to the right, over the line, to the conscience side. So if you're in doubt, you should go a little extra. But don't overdo it. You understand? But the truth is you have to evaluate. Now, if you live your life this way by evaluation and not by your conscience and not by your laziness, then you will find that you don't know what your abilities are. So, the question is when the Rambam says that you should go a little bit to your conscience, so the question is, why don't you go exactly to the middle? And why should you go towards your conscience side? Maybe you could go towards your laziness side, since they're both emotions. The answer is that the animalistic part of you is stronger than the conscience. And it's easier to give up the more strict way if you went too far than to give up the easy way that's totally in line with the animalistic part of you. So therefore, it's better to go by the strict way. And if you made a mistake, so then you can move a little bit to the left. There are two reasons why you should go to the conscience. One is the one we mentioned, that it's easier to come to the, it's easier to come back if you find you made a mistake, if you went too far, than going from laziness to pushing yourself. And two is that the odds are that the animalistic, you want to give in to the animalistic part. So the odds are, if you lean too much to the left, it's a high probability that it's the emotions that the animalistic part is getting you. You see, we're not too worried about the conscience. Even though, we see in our world that there's a lot of right-wingers in all areas. You understand? It goes very strict. You got to make a rational decision. It has to be a rational decision, and every rational decision must be, what in reality should you do? What are my capabilities? And I must know exactly my capabilities. And if I'm not 100% sure of my capabilities, I should go a little bit to the right. That is the way. I'm only giving an example by vacation, but this is the way you should think of all problems. And the same thing, vacation is every day too. Sometimes a person needs a certain break during the day. The same evaluation has to be made, how much you need everyday life, how much you could work during the week, and also based on your personality. I know somebody that worked 18 hours. He used to learn 18 hours a day, and then he used to sleep over Shabbos and parts of Sunday. You understand? The weekends was like himself at 5, and sometimes even more, even on Shabbos and Sunday, he would learn also a little bit. But he would put in like 18 hours a day. Then at the end of the week, you need a break. Some people can't do that. They need a break every day. So they can't learn 18 hours. Maybe they're going to learn 10 hours. It depends on, you have to evaluate each aspect of your area. And sometimes you need a total break. Even when you have a total break, do you need a total break? Or should you go on vacation with a chavrusa and learn 2 hours in the morning and then enjoy life? Or do you need a total break? The odds are most people don't, I would assume. But sometimes you can't learn by yourself, you can't force yourself, so you got to go to chavrusa. That hinders you a little bit, because then you have to compromise with the person you're going with. But the thing is that you must work it out exactly according to your needs. You see, what your needs are. What does reality demand? The Rambam is talking about where a person could learn and he doesn't need these breaks. So you shouldn't take the time out for it. But if you can't, then you must live as close to your ability as close as possible. That is your level of eating bread and salt and water. All decisions in life should not be allowed by the emotions, but should be guided by the mind. And even when you decide to give in to your emotions, that must be the mind deciding to give in to your emotions. The mind deciding. And every time you make an evaluation, there's two parts. What does reality demand? And by reality, I mean outside. What is the ultimate? Then two, how much could I partake of the reality? Sometimes I could take all of it, sometimes not. And two, in my evaluation, I have to make sure that there's no emotion affecting my decision. I just want to explain what I mean a little bit to the move a little bit to the right. Let's say you feel you could learn between 5 and 7 hours. In other words, you have a ballpark figure of what you could tolerate over a day. So then you should go to the extreme of 7 hours, and then if you can't do it, so then drop down to 6.5. The extreme is where you can only do 7 hours, and you push yourself to try and beat the guy that's doing 18 hours, and he has the ability and you don't have the ability. It could affect your whole mind. First of all, you could hate it. You know, they say about Mark Spitz, he won seven medals for swimming. They say he never went back into the pool. Just lately I heard, this goes back many years, just lately I heard he started going back to swimming a little bit. But the thing is basically, he hated it. He just did it for the medals. And he drove himself to get those medals. He had the ability to do it, but then he hated the whole thing. Now, well, you got to be very, very careful that you shouldn't hate it. And the case that I know was the guy actually affected his psyche. I mean, it affected him in an adverse way in his psychological makeup. When the Rambam says that you should live on bread and water, bread and salt and water, right? So I always wondered what the salt is. Is the salt that they held it was healthy, or was just for taste, and that they allow you an extra taste? I don't know what they're doing, but anyway. So the thing is, I'm saying your level of going to that far has to be decided by who you are. That is the ultimate where you could live your life, where nothing will affect your learning. You see? Like Reb Shimon ben Yochai, where he moved into this cave for 12 years, and that's it. It didn't affect him. He was able to learn. But any one of us, if we moved into the cave, we'd be crazy in a year. Forget about 12 years. You know what I mean? Because we need certain extra things. But the thing is that insofar as that is the ultimate, you see, that you should be able to do that. Now, your bread and water is going, when you work out, again, I'll go over that, when you work out, objectively, what is the ultimate? The ultimate is bread and water. Now I must take in consideration my personality, and whether my personality could go that far. So then I figure I need a certain amount of breaks during the day, and I need a certain amount of break, like once a year, to take off. Now the question is how much do I actually need? So when you work that out, then you have to make sure that your conscience didn't affect you, that it made you go too far to the right, which would take away from your learning. Or if your laziness took over and you went too far to the left, so then you're not learning enough, you see? So therefore, we said that, in other words, let's say a person usually knows approximately how much he could take. Ballpark figure, let's say between 5 and 7. So he should take the 7. That's moving a little bit more to the conscience side, but he shouldn't go to 12 hours or 13 hours. That's definitely out of his realm. He shouldn't allow either competition or religiosity or whatever the emotion is that drives him. He shouldn't allow it to destroy him. Because if he goes too far, it can destroy him. We're in Proverbs chapter 13, verse 6. And it says, Tzedakah, that's charity, protects a Tom his way. What's a Tom? That Tom is upright. His path is upright. Okay, or right, upright. Okay, and the wicked is there. Oh, and the wicked And the wicked, their wickedness makes them crooked. You know, in modern times you also have the word a crook. It comes from being crooked, that your road is crooked, not straight. Say, Tom is probably straight. Yeah, it would be the opposite. We'll have to see how it works out. Okay? And so his evil makes him crooked. Okay? So that's the verse. Okay? So the charity makes the protects or guards the uprighteous, the people that are on the uprighteous road, and wickedness causes the wicked, the wicked acts, the wicked acts of the wicked make them crooked. Okay? That's what he's saying. The question is, what is he being saved from? The righteous, and how are they being saved? What saves them? And what does it mean the wicked are crooked? That their wickedness makes them crooked. What is that crooked? Okay, once again, the translation: the righteous are God. The tzedakah, charity, guards the upright of way. In other words, who goes in the path? I guess he goes in the path of righteousness. And the guy that is wicked, his wickedness makes him crooked or distorted. Okay, the question is, let's say there is a wicked person and he gives tzedakah. I mean, there are people that way. So the question is, would that tzedakah protect them? Yeah, somebody wants to say that where you're giving charity, it's giving of yourself. Okay, when you say giving of yourself, what is the motive? What's motivating this guy to give charity? In other words, if he was raised that way, or some or halacha, or some religious conscience, I mean. The question is, would that really protect him if he's going by his conscience? That we've just said that conscience could be dangerous. So if he's just giving tzedakah from his conscience, then you can't say that. And it can't be the conscience. They want to say that, no, since he's a Tom, since he's the upright, upright means that he's going by his mind. Okay? So when you go by your mind, what does it mean? Charity, tzedakah, protect you. How does it protect you? And also the question is that the first half is talking about, like, it seems to be an act of charity, a very particular case, while the second half is a universal of wickedness. So what's the connection between the, how you can connect the first part to the second part? I like explaining the logic. Like, for instance, you could compare an animal to a human, you understand, by saying that we're both animals, but a human thinks. But you can't compare a monkey to a human. A monkey is totally different. In other words, it's another, it's a species, it's a particular of the animal kingdom. And the you must make the distinction where it must be equal. In other words, a particular case on one side and a universal on the other, you cannot make opposites out of. They have to be either two particulars that are in the same category that are opposites. They somehow must be in the same category that are opposites, or two universals. The question question that's being asked is, is crookedness evil itself? If it's evil, then what is he saying? An evil person will become crooked because he already is crooked. Okay? Or crooked is something separate from evil, and evil causes crookedness. Very good question. That's very good. Again, the question is the difference between the first half and the second half. The first half says that the wickedness causes this crooked, the wickedness causes crookedness. But in the first half of the pasuk, it doesn't add something, it guards it. Okay, what is it guarding? In other words, it's not, the first half talks about where he seems to be affected. Over here, it's not that it's a new thing, but it guards it. somehow guards it. You understand? So what is the guarding? Is it inherent? Does it become inherent, or is it an outside factor? How does it work? And the question is how to approach the problem altogether. My approach, I would say, is that you should go over in your mind the different questions and wait for your intuition to lead to which point you think would be the guide to the rest of the pasuk. It could be you're totally off, but you have no choice. You can only rely on your intuition, and then guided by that intuition, if there are contradictions that will not lead you any place, so then the contradictions should show the mind that it should not continue in this area, right? That the contradiction should naturally show the mind that you don't continue in this area, and now you let your intuition roam again over all the facts and see where it'll take you next, and that's how you remove possibility and possibility. As you continue learning, the intuition comes in line with the ideas where you're able to go faster to the source of where it is. But anyway, I think you should not look for the answer, but you go let your mind roll over the questions until your intuition leads you to where you want to be guided. And Rabbi Weiss wants to say like this. Every human being, nobody's born absolutely evil, okay? People are born with different emotions pulling both ways. You understand? So the second half is a person starting out in evil. So the evil will distort his mind and make him more crooked in his ways. In other words, you continue on the path of evil. Then when you start out, you're a person that's in conflict. But as you start making decisions towards evil, those decisions affect your personality. When it affects your personality, it distorts. Instead of looking at life from reality point of view, you're moving more and more towards the emotional point of view. So therefore, it's true when you start out evil, we're not talking about Hitler, where he was at the ultimate end of evil. But when a person starts out, they're not that way. Nobody's born on the ultimate level of evil. There's a certain, and it would not be free will. So the thing is, he's in a point of free will, and every time he moves towards incorrect decisions, towards his evil ways, so it affects his personality. So when it affects his personality, so therefore he gets worse. So don't think that you remain the same. You understand? Hitler started out by making certain type of decisions which were good in the beginning. But then he relied more and more on his feelings. He gave up on the logic more and more. If you read about how he made decisions later on, till he reached a point where he was sending out troops that did not exist anymore. He became totally psychotic. He moves away from reality. You see what I mean? And in the first half it says, Tam Darech. In other words, he's on the road to perfection. He's not there yet. You understand? It's a road to perfection. He's not there. He's starting out also in the middle. Right? But he's moving in that direction. So when he gives charity, it means, even though he's not perfected yet, but it means that he recognizes that a system, that you must live within a system. And as he lives the system, and as he studies the system and recognizes how the acts are based on a system, it makes him more consistent. What is a system? System means that anytime there's a contradiction, it must be answered. So any inconsistency, he's always working on to remove. So whenever he makes a decision, this part of him will make him check out every inconsistency. So when he checks out the inconsistencies because of this approach, it will protect him from making incorrect decisions. So the subject is people that are starting out in life and making decisions. There's one person that's moving towards evil and making more and more decisions in line with his emotions. that very decision is going to affect him. Every time he does a wicked act, it will affect his personality. While the person that's moving towards the world of reality, so he's working towards systems, right? So when he gives charity, it's because it fits into a system. And as he moves in that direction, he's more aware of inconsistencies, and when he has to make decisions in his own personal life, so then he will make sure there is no inconsistencies in that part of his life. It's not the recognition that charity is a value. It's that charity is part of a system, and therefore, even though I'm giving up of myself, in other words, in the first half, the second half, by the wicked person, so in that part, he's taking for himself. But the other person is giving of himself because he recognizes a system. That's his value. His value is a system. And even though giving charity is a very difficult thing, it's giving up. In other words, if you give 10% of your money, if you had $100, now you can only spend 90. You're giving away money that you could spend on yourself. Okay? So therefore, we're not talking about a person that, an extremist. We're talking about a person that recognizes reality and he's giving away his money. Could have put it in the bank. He could have even been learning more because he'll have more money in the bank. But he recognizes, no, I'll have to work a little harder. But I must recognize that a system is that if I make it second nature, that a system is important, then that will always help me recognize inconsistencies. And the more inconsistencies I recognize, the better I'm able to protect myself in my decision-making part of me. In other words, the pasuk is not talking about the fact that you're benefiting somebody else. That the fact that you're benefiting somebody else, there might be a value in that. I don't know. But our verse is not talking about that. Our verse is talking about the benefit insofar as you make correct decisions. Okay? The question is, why did it use the example of tzedakah and not like an example of keeping Shabbos, which is also a part of the system? Okay? The answer is that the religious emotion will tell me to keep Shabbos. But there's no religious emotion that I should help others. You know what I mean? That's a nice person that helps others, but it's not a religious act. Most religions, that I've seen, we advocate helping anybody, to understand. There's certain that, but in most religions, it's not part of the religion to be, in other words, it's easy for me to subjugate myself to God than to subjugate myself to a system of people, my relationship to people. So therefore, there is no proof that it's really I do it because of the system. I might be doing it because of my relationship to God. But when I do it to people, I have to subjugate myself to people, and it should not make a difference if I know the person, if I like the person. It's just where I'm obligated to give charity. It has nothing to do whether I like the person or don't like the person. In fact, there's an interesting halacha. It says that if two people are, one is loading his donkey and one is unloading his donkey. Says you should help the person that's unloading his donkey because since that if you do that quicker, so that will give relief to the animal. So you should think about the animal. What if your enemy is loading the donkey, and your friend is unloading the donkey? Then it says you should help your enemy unload the donkey. You see, I think it's for this reason what we're saying here. That you should not recognize who the person that you're giving it to. That's not part of the recognition. It's because you recognize the system, not the person. It's a change in your relationship to why you do things. When you do for people, you do for your family, you do for your friends, but you don't do it because you recognize the importance of a system. We're saying what benefits you here is that you recognize the importance of a system and you live by that system and you don't recognize who you're doing it for. The fact that he's your enemy, that shouldn't play any role in it. The question is, does this guy need help or not? That's all. And am I responsible to help him? That's all. The question is, why does the system change around if it's your enemy? Because your perfection and your relationship to the system comes before the animal. If there is absolutely no benefit to a human, so then you have to think of the animal. But insofar as human perfection is concerned, that must come first. That takes priority. That's why the Torah says that you should help your enemy. And the question is that we see that people in other religions give charity, and they give charity, like sometimes to even 10%. They even give 10% or more, you know what I mean? The answer is their charity is to their own group, to the religious. In other words, they give to the church. They give to the mosque. You see, it's no difference than for us Shabbos. You see, it becomes a religious act, my relationship to God. But we're saying that your charity, you could even give to somebody, you should protect somebody you don't like. I mean, the question is that we made a distinction between that tzedakah doesn't lend itself to the religious emotion, so therefore it should only be for the so therefore that's why they chose tzedakah. But since we see other religions do give tzedakah, so we see it could be for a religious component. That is the question. So Rabbi Weiss wants to say that there's a distinction between, in other words, insofar as Torah is concerned, the purpose of the mitzvah of tzedakah, the purpose of the mitzvah of tzedakah is to exemplify the system, is to bring out the system. Shabbos I could relate to, even if I don't recognize the system. I could keep all the halachas of Shabbos. But the purpose of this very mitzvah is to recognize the, and especially the way the halachas set up, like we showed before, it definitely shows you that it's really for the system. While in other religions, it doesn't exemplify the system, but it's they're made as part of their religious, part of the religious system that they're obligated to give to the church or to the mosque or whatever. All right. So the question is that there are organizations and that are totally dedicated to the giving of charity and helping poor people and working it out for poor people. Right? The answer is that there it's a result is because of that I feel good about giving. Here the purpose of the Torah and the way it's set up, especially where it shows you that you, in a regular case you should help one person, the guy that's taking off the package from the donkey, and where your friend is putting, where your enemy, but if it's your enemy and your friend, and the person you don't like is helping put the, you have to help him put the load on the donkey first. You see, the system is set up for the purpose of recognizing the system. That's the way it's set up. Not so when they give to charity. You feel good, you're helping others, you understand, you'll get a reward in heaven, whatever it is, but it's for the reward, not because of the system itself. And the benefit of the system is that it will protect you in your thinking. In your thinking, it will protect you, not the act itself. It's not the act, it's the relationship to the system. The question is, why did they use tzedakah? Why did they use justice? Why did they use charity? Why did they use justice? The answer is that there's justice. People recognize that there should be a system of justice. Practically every society has what they do to murderers, to criminals. You have to have a society. They don't see it as a system. Again, they see it as a practical thing to exist. To exist, right? But they don't see it as a value inherent in a system. Tzedakah, or helping people as part of a system, not because of the feeling towards the person, and not because any relationship to the person, but because of the system, that is only a Torah idea. That is a Torah idea. There's no other place that you find that idea. That the system itself is the value. And the benefit, King Solomon is saying, is that you will think clearer and it will protect you from making mistakes. It won't distort your mind. Like the second hand, it will distort your mind or make your mind crooked. Okay, we're up to chapter 13, verse 7. And it says, there are those that are wealthy and they don't have anything. And there are those that are poor and they're extremely wealthy. A little puzzle. Nisar Sher and Nisro Shesh, okay, one is to make himself, they both mean to make himself rich or make himself poor. But it could mean in two different senses. It could be in the sense that he actually makes himself rich or he makes himself poor. Or he makes believe he is rich or he makes believe he is poor. That is the two translations. So my advice would be is to take one of them, follow it through, and then take the other way. Okay? So therefore, the verse says like this. There are people that make themselves rich, one of the two ways, and he has nothing. And there are people that make themselves poor, and they have great treasures, honus treasures. They have great treasures. We're going to try that he makes himself rich literally, not pretends, okay? So the pasuk is like this. There are those people that make themselves rich, and they have nothing. And they're those people that make themselves poor, and they have great treasure. We're talking about that he makes himself rich, okay? It means money. We'll start out that it's literal, but however, if questions force us, then we could get metaphorical. But we always start out literally, okay? All right, and the questions have to guide us, okay? So the thing is, the first question is, why should a person make himself poor? Ridiculous. Okay, that's the first question. Okay, a little bit of clarification on the grammar. Miss Asher means that he is constantly making, because it's in the present, he is making himself rich and he has nothing. And the second half, he is making himself poor and great wealth. Okay? So the question is, why should a person be constantly making himself poor? And also, it's very strange that a person is constantly working towards wealth and he has nothing. I mean, how's that possible? You understand? And a person is making himself poor and yet he is rich? I mean, it doesn't make sense altogether. The whole thing is like a riddle. You understand? It just doesn't make sense. This whole statement doesn't make sense. Again, the statement is saying that he's doing the act of getting wealthy and he has nothing, and the other one, he is in the act of making himself poor and he has everything. I mean, we're talking about money, so that's the way we're leaving it at this point, unless we decide to make it metaphorical. Even if you're going to learn it as a metaphor, like it's talking about knowledge, so he says there are those that are working on knowledge and they don't have anything. And there is people that are not working on knowledge, and they have all the knowledge. The question is, also, how do you make yourself poor? What does it mean? He is constantly making himself poor. How do you make yourself poor? We discussed what it means to make yourself poor. So somebody wanted to say that that it must be that he spends his money. So we said, well, no, maybe it means that not to work. So they said, no, that's not an act of making yourself poor, that's passive. But however, if you make a decision not to work, then not working is, the fact that you're not working, it's passive, okay? But however, you are active because you made the decision. So that is, you are making decision to stay poor. You understand? So therefore, you're making yourself poor because you made a decision. Passive would be, if I'm too lazy to work, I really know that I should work, but I don't. You understand? I should do something, but I don't. So that's passive. That's passive. It's not a decision. The emotions make the decision. The emotions just say, don't bother. The mind is not working. If you think about it based on the emotions, that's still passive. I'm talking about where you think through what is right and what is wrong. Where you evaluate the two sides and you come to a decision, you should make yourself poor. So therefore, it could be what it's talking about, that you made a decision not to work. Right, somebody wants to say that that if the second half is active, meaning you made a decision to become poor, so then the first half should also be we made a decision to become wealthy, right? But since there is a consequence that he has nothing, so definitely King Solomon is pointing out that that the first half is an emotional decision and the second half is a logical decision, like he always makes these distinctions between the emotional and the rationale. The question is, why does it say there are people that make themselves wealthy and they don't have anything? In other words, it seems to imply that there are people that are working on wealth and they have something. Okay? So that's also an implication which seems to contradict the second half. You know what I mean? Like, we still don't have what's going on here. There's still a problem. But anyway, that's a new problem. The more problems you have, the more guides you have. Somebody wants to say that it has to do with the inner workings of a human being. If the purpose of the person is to make himself wealthy, that's his end in life, so then he'll have nothing. He won't have any enjoyment out of life. He'll lose out on all aspects of life. Okay? While a person that makes himself poor, what it does mean is that he's working on wealth, but that's not his ultimate goal. You understand? But that's not the words. In other words, that possibility doesn't fit into the words, make yourself poor. So Laura wants to say that it is impossible for a person to consciously make a decision to become poor without any motive. Right? There has to be a motive. I mean, unless you're stupid. You understand? A person is a moron, so we could do that. But we're saying he makes a conscious decision. So there must be a motive. What is the motive? And it has to be in the pasuk. Laura wants to say that since he is not making money, then wealth must have a different definition. Or when he doesn't have anything, it is different than the wealth. So she's making a distinction between, in other words, there is wealth and he doesn't have anything. But it's not talking about wealth. It says he has nothing. Okay? And there is that a person that makes himself poor, and he has everything, and the everything can be wealth. That's a beautiful step. It's a beautiful step, even though you don't know the next step. But I mean, it's a beautiful step to take. Beautiful. There was a man by the name of Jacob. And sages say that for 14 years he learned in Shem Ve'Ever. There was a school at the time that Yaakov learned in, and he was extremely poor. And then he went out into the world, and he went and became extremely wealthy. You see? So the thing is sometimes when you start out, you must start out in the world of learning. You must make yourself poor. But that doesn't mean you have to live a poor life. In other words, you must at the beginning put all your energy into the world of learning. Until your personality changes, until the knowledge is great enough, then you could evaluate at a certain point how much time you should put into work and how much not. You can evaluate, and that's one type of making yourself poor. You need to start out in learning. You cannot be involved in, you know what I mean? There's a lot that you have to do. depending on your personality, but there's a lot of the physical world that you have to give up on. You have to give up a lot. You understand? I mean, I understand we can't live like Rav Shimon ben Yochai, who moved into a cave, or even like our sages, that Hillel used to work in the morning till he made 11 cents. He used to pay 7 cents tuition, and 4 cents he used to leave for his wife. He used to buy a few days old bread. Ha 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 ha
fact is, as much as you can, as much as your personality will allow, you have to be involved in the world of learning. You have to know your personality. That was what we discussed the other day, this idea that you have to know your personality. You know what I mean? So that's one possibility. There are some people that cannot divide their energy into two parts. And it could be that type of person has to make a decision not to work for wealth at all. Because at any time he works for wealth, because he doesn't have a lot of energy, it'll take him out of learning. So he has to make himself stay poor his whole life. A person has to know himself, to know whether he could become like the Rabbeinu Yonah. He was so rich that he built himself a castle. And Yehuda Nasi was so wealthy that when his horses neighed at feeding time, he used to hear it miles around. So, I mean, these people are very wealthy, but it means that they were able to, after a while, they were able to divide their energy. But however, most people cannot. So you have to know. I removed the statistics. I don't know most or a lot. I don't know statistics. I'm just saying, but there are people that cannot. For them, they'd have to make themselves poor for the rest of their lives. So you have to know, for learning, you have to be willing to live on the minimum that your personality needs to be able to learn. In that way, the pasuk makes sense. It says, there are those that work for wealth, they're constantly working for wealth, they have no learning at all. They'll never have learning. You're going to find a half hour, an hour, some day in the day to learn, which is a nice thing, it's a good thing. But the development that we're talking about, to be a chacham and to develop, that you have to put in your energies. You understand? Second guy realizes, especially at the beginning, he can't divide his energy. So as much as possible, he stays away from work practicing completely until he's either on the level that he could divide so he can make some more money, or if he realizes that if he goes into work, that it'll take away from his learning, so that person might have to stay on a lower standard of living so he can his whole life to continue his learning. If you remember at the beginning of this tape, we were talking about making decisions about vacation. Here again, you could see the idea that you really have to evaluate who you are. You understand? But simultaneously, you must know your needs, what your abilities are, what you could do. You understand? Like, you can't just live like Hillel. I mean, we live in a totally different society. I mean, it takes us years to become like, even if it's possible. It might not even be possible to become like a person like Hillel that just made 11 cents a day. But the thing is that it's an evaluation. You have to know how to evaluate what my needs are and nothing more. Even in the monetary world, have the life of learning. In chapter 2, verse 4, it says, it's talking about wisdom. He says, if you search for it like money, and like hidden treasures, okay, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and the knowledge of God you will find. In other words, King Solomon is saying is that a person that puts all his energy, like you see people put their whole energy, like Aristotle Onassis, he says when he made his first million, he took a vacation. He only worked 12 hours that day. That was his vacation. Okay? So you see, that's what it means, searching for money. You understand? When you give up your life for money and nothing else has any meaning except money, that takes precedence over everything. And I'm saying that that's the same thing. That's what King Solomon is saying here, where all your energy is put into learning. But simultaneously, you have to be careful. If you don't take care of your needs, your absolute needs, so then you won't be able to learn. It'll affect you. Like, for instance, let's say a question of having money in the bank. Right? Well, that depends on how secure you are. I mean, to live by day, just make the amount of money that you need for the day and not for tomorrow. You know what I mean? That's a tremendous amount of security that you need to live that way. Or trust in God, or, I mean, whatever it is. But that's what it says. There was a machlokas. it says that Rav Shimon ben Yochai says that if a person, how should a person work? He says a person should not, he should only do for the day, immediate, and he should not bother, he should just the rest of the time learn. Or Rabbi Yishmael says a person should learn a trade, and then he should learn. So the Gemara says statistics. They say a lot tried like Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, and they failed. And a lot tried like Rabbi Yishmael, and they were successful. So you see, most people need that security that they have to have some type of way of making a living. You see? So but you have to know your personality. If you could live like Rav Shimon ben Yochai with nothing and just for the day, or very little, so then fine. But that's a rarity. Most people can't. So here's statistics. The Gemara states statistics here. So, but the thing is most people are not that way. Most people need security, so they have to have a trade. And today, what security means, you have to investigate what security means, how much money you should have in insurance, what type of insurance, how much insurance do you need, how much do you have to bank. The bank should be only for an emergency, you understand? So the thing is all these things. What about retirement? I mean, whether you need it or not, you have to know what your needs are, how far in advance you have to prepare, and how much you should put into learning, and how much you could do for the physical, more for the physical, and it won't take away from your learning. I'm sure Rabbeinu Yona, or Rabbeinu Tam, who was very wealthy, didn't take away from his learning. But he was able to become wealthy without it taking away from his learning. That's a real person. You see, the Avos were that way. Rabbi Yitzchak and Yaakov were very wealthy. And I'm sure it wasn't at the expense of their learning. And I'm sure they did a lot of Torah mitzvahs with them. Right, the question is why is it that a person like Rabbeinu Yona, or Rabbeinu Tam, would become wealthy? Why should he make himself wealthy? I knew a person that was wealthy. He was an entrepreneur, and he used to drive around in a Cadillac. At that time, the Cadillac was the best car of the times. So I asked him, why does he have a Cadillac? You know, he was from a yeshiva, so he understood the question. You understand? So he said that because when he goes out to do business, if you drive up with a Chevrolet, they look at you different than if you drive up with a Cadillac. I had a student that his father was a multimillionaire, and so when he would go out of town to do business, he'd rent a stretch limousine, he would rent a penthouse, you know what I mean, and dress like a, you know, dress like for show, you understand, because they look at you differently. Now, Chazal, when they became wealthy, I mean, they used this wealth, first of all, for political gains for Klal Yisrael and for the nation of Israel, and also they would do it to attract people to the world of learning. You understand? So, therefore, I don't think they did it for personal, for any personal, because personally they needed it. I think they did it because of the benefit for it. Somehow they recognize the benefit in their situation that to help Klal Yisrael be better off if they were rich. And so therefore, if it didn't take them out of learning, if it took them out of learning, then it would be very questionable whether they should do it. So in other words, if I had to go back to make a distinction, I would say you should not become wealthy unless you're in a situation that you recognize that wealth could benefit Israel somehow, some way. That the wealth itself could benefit. If it can't benefit Israel, it's only benefiting yourself. It could be that you should not become wealthy. Could be you should always be. Could be that you should make yourself poor. Could be. In other words, don't, by making yourself poor, I mean don't go out to make money. All right, we're doing Mishlei, chapter 13, verse 8. It says, the atonement of the soul of a man is his wealth, and a poor person did not hear chastisement or rebuke. Okay? So the first question is, what is he talking about? On the second half, I'd just like to ask one question. It says a poor person didn't hear a chastisement. And the thing is, why, what do you mean? I could understand the wicked, you know, but why a poor person? Okay? And secondly, what is when he says chastisement, what does he mean by chastisement? What is chastisement? The next question of the second half, we're only dealing with the second half, is that he did not hear. That means he did not hear, he does not listen. Okay? Now we have to make a decision on. I don't know yet. Maybe not. I don't know. Okay. Okay, the question is, is it a poor person doesn't listen to rebuke, or that he didn't listen to the rebuke is the cause for him to be poor? Right? Okay, once again, you have to know the subject matter of Mishlei. See, there's two types of poor people. There's a poor person that became poor as a result of circumstance. You understand? There's a poor person that becomes poor because of his laziness. Okay? You understand? Now, and Mishlei is always talking about where it is your fault, okay? Where you are the cause. In other words, you have to make the correct decision, and you are the cause for your predicament. Where there are outside causes, you understand, which is beyond your ability, where it's your relationship to reality or relationship to God, you see? But however, Mishlei is talking about where the result is because of you. The results are because of you. It doesn't deal with outside circumstances. Okay? So the thing is that we're talking about that now what is chastisement? What is chastisement? You gotta be careful. Chastisement, usually when you think of chastisement, the first thing you think of somebody telling you off, somebody beating you, right? That's not King Solomon. King Solomon doesn't think of chastisement that way. He thinks of chastisement as telling you the consequences of your life. That's his whole book. If you look at the book of Mishlei, it's always telling you the consequences of your actions. Okay? So the only reason what would cause a person to be poor, that where he himself causes himself to be poor, you see, it must be a result of that he doesn't recognize the consequences of his actions. So he became poor because he doesn't think through the consequences of his actions. That is the second half. So therefore, the second half of the pasuk is that a person became poor because he did not listen to chastisement. In other words, when somebody tells him, you do this wrong thing, there's going to be certain consequences, he doesn't listen, he doesn't think it through what the person is saying, but he just goes his own way. And so therefore, he gets the consequences. Doesn't mean when somebody gives you advice, that doesn't mean you have to listen, but in other words, that you have to obey. You have to listen and think it over and see if you should accept the advice, that you must make the decision. But we're not talking about that you must obey what somebody tells you. But you must understand. That's the whole book of Mishlei, where you understand why it is right or wrong to do a certain act. You see? So therefore, when somebody... either you don't listen to advice altogether, or you listen to advice and then you work it through. It's not that you just obey the person. Obeying the person is not... It's not what Mishlei is talking about. That's halacha, halacha. You got to obey God, and that's all. You know what I mean? Nasa v'nishma. We'll do it, even though we don't understand it yet. Okay? So, but in Mishlei, the purpose is that you must understand why you're making a decision. Not obey people, but understand. That's listening. Listening means that I make the decision. But however, I understand what the person is saying, what his reasons are, what my counter reasons are, and then work it out which way is right. Okay? So therefore, based on the book of Mishlei, you see what the subject is, is that is what the pasuk is saying, that they didn't listen to when people told them the consequences of his action. They even bothered thinking about it. The question on the second half, I mean the first half, the question on the first half is, what does it mean, his wealth? Okay? I mean, it's definitely, I mean, atonement of the soul. First of all, what is atonement of the soul? What does that mean? And two is, what is his wealth? I mean, atonement of the soul can't be money, doesn't seem to be anyway. I mean, it's hard to say because I don't know what atonement is yet. Okay? That's basically the question. So Gabi wants to take one step. He says that you can't understand the first half in and of itself, but maybe we could understand it via the second half and interpret it based on the information that we got out of the second half, because since the pasuk must be opposites, so therefore we can, once we have understanding of the second half, it is possible that we could understand the first half. Before we go on, I'd just like to clarify that there's really two logical methods. Sometimes you have to get information from the total subject of the book, based on the subject of the book, and sometimes you can get information from the subject of the particular pasuk that you're learning from. In other words, the category, what you see from one side, so then you get the other side, and you can't go directly, get it directly from the words itself, only through outside methods. So we're saying, based on the second half, we're saying, what is the atonement of the soul according to King Solomon? We're talking about where he recognizes the consequences of his actions, and he repents on it, right? That he changes his way. Mishlei is for the beginner. Since it's for the beginner, it's not a person on, like a Navi or a Tatana, you know what I mean? It's a person that's beginning. It's beginning, so therefore he still has this conflict. But he listens to chastisement, and he listens to the consequences, and he listens, and he works it through, and then decides which way he wants to go. So therefore, rich is the word rich in the pasuk is a metaphor. So according to this, what is the definition of wealth? According to this idea, where a person listens to the consequences, that is his wealth. So the question is, what is the definition of wealth according to the pasuk? As a metaphor, it's a metaphor. Definitely, wealth literally definitely means money, but over here, wealth is a metaphor. According to the metaphor, what is the definition of wealth? There are two questions against what I'm saying to this point. Well, the second half of the pasuk was talking about poor insofar as money is concerned, and so therefore the first half would not be wealth. It cannot be wealth metaphorically. It should be literally the same thing. And two is that maybe that his atonement means that he will become wealthy because he does listen. Okay? But if you translate the pasuk according to the way we translated the pasuk, is that the atonement of a man's soul is his wealth, not that he will become wealthy. It says oshro is his wealth. So therefore, I have to go my way with all the questions. In other words, we're saying that the definition of wealth is his atonement of a soul. Atonement of a soul means he corrects himself, like Yom Kippur. He corrects himself. He atones for sins by changing. You see? So therefore, we're saying that his atonement must be that he listens to chastisement. Okay? That he listens and he thinks about it. And then it says, that is his wealth. Now, we have two questions, but I think first we have to answer the question. Despite the question, sometimes when you're working creatively, a question means that you're not finished with the process. So therefore, you can't answer all the questions. But that doesn't mean I shouldn't go along with the process that I have been working on. A lot of people are afraid to go on because they feel, well, I have to answer all the questions first. No, you don't have to answer all the questions. You have to answer all the questions after you're done. But just go along the process and see where it leads. If you can't answer the contradictions, so then you might have to retract. But see where it leads, even if you don't have the answer to all your questions, when you're working on it. But after you finish, then you should check out the questions, see if you answered all the questions. Okay, so the East Coast wants to say that in other words, where a person atones, in other words, where he recognizes the consequences, so he recognizes that which is good. The recognition of that which is good, insofar as life is concerned, that which is the good, that is a person's wealth. That's greater wealth than money. In other words, that's what it's really saying. It's saying that insofar as having everything you want, the essence is having the good, you see. So therefore, a person's wealth is his recognition of that which is good, and the good in our subject is the looking at the consequences of your life. That's the good that we're talking about. That is the good. All right, the question that we have when we say the word good, what is the definition of the word good? In other words, what makes something a good? When you define it, wealth is good too, okay? But we're saying this is the good, okay? When we say that it's his wealth, we're saying the word good, I don't know if it's the correct word. I'd rather define the word wealth first. Before I get to the word good, you know what I mean? I think we should stick with the pasuk without jumping and define the word wealth. I think when we went to the word good, I think there's a jump here. We skipped a step away from the pasuk. Okay? So the thing is, we should go back and define how he is defining, how he, King Solomon, is defining wealth. In other words, we're not saying it brings to wealth the redemption of the soul, but that is his wealth. I'm putting it on tape. In other words, the word good, when you said the word good, like the good life, or what is the good in life, that was a step taken from other source, the way you talk, the way you express yourself, from some other source, but it's not coming directly from the pasuk. And so therefore, well, let's stick with the pasuk, and let the pasuk speak to us. Whenever you're working with metaphors, what you have to do is take the word literally. Wealth and money, okay? Now, the question is, when you have money, in other words, a person that desires money, okay, and wants money, when he has his money, what does he have? What does he have? He has in his mind that he could totally satisfy himself. The quality of wealth usually means that I could have anything I want, meaning that I could satisfy every aspect of my life. You understand? That's what wealth is. That's the quality of wealth that I think King Solomon, in other words, in metaphors, you have to define the metaphor according to the subject. And sometimes you could define wealth one way and define wealth another way. The question is, which quality fits in best, okay, in this situation? So we're taking wealth to mean where you can satisfy every aspect of your life, okay? And the truth is that is not true. That is not true. A person can be very wealthy and still not be happy, and still not be satisfied in a lot of areas. It's really a fake out. What the King Solomon is saying, that to satisfy all your needs, you must be in line with reality. Okay? In other words, there are two things. There's a person that tries to fit reality into his needs. So he has a need for power, for wealth, So therefore, he looks at life and tries to fit everything and feel. And he feels when he starts out that he will be satisfied when he has this. But the truth is, he will not be. It's a fake out. You see? He's saying satisfaction, to get satisfaction out of the physical world, is you must be able to recognize what the physical world has to offer. In other words, the wealthy man monetarily did not analyze what the physical world is. He had a certain feeling, and he looks at the physical world that, based on this feeling, the wealth will satisfy him. But it's not true. What King Solomon is saying, what will satisfy you is if you recognize reality and then change your life around to fit into reality, that is the only way a person can be satisfied. By atonement, we said that we're starting out with a person that's a beginner, which means that he has certain desires and then he recognizes reality. And he has to change his emotions in line with reality. Then, in that case, you could be totally satisfied. You understand? So he says, therefore, that is his wealth. You see? So therefore, to answer all our questions, we must take the second half. Now we have to change the second half, that a poor person is not that he's poor of money, but that the definition of a poor person is that he doesn't listen to reality. He doesn't listen to what the reality is telling him, but he tries to live his life based on his feelings, not on his reality. That is the real poor person. While the rich person, the one that is really sad, will really be satisfied. In other words, you could be wealthy monetarily, and according to this pasuk, you'll be considered a poor man, because you're really not satisfied. You're only satisfied one part, that you have wealth, you can buy physical things. But you're not in line with reality. That part will never be satisfied. You'll strive for things that don't exist. You can't be satisfied that way. You see? There's another person that could be poor, and he could be wealthy, because he's totally in line with reality. You see? So therefore, you must say that the pasuk, the subject of the pasuk, is what satisfies, what is the real satisfaction? If a person is looking for satisfaction, what is satisfaction? How do you get satisfaction? The answer is, you first must look at reality to know what reality has to offer, and then fit your emotions into that reality, and not to try to go outside of reality. Because if you're the other half, if you do the other half, that you try to live according to your emotions, not according to reality, then you will never be satisfied, which means you're a poor person. You can't satisfy yourself. In other words, the pasuk is telling me this. Most people think that I am satisfied if I, you know, like if I know what my emotions are, and then I try to satisfy those emotions. What the pasuk is saying, before you could do that, you must know what reality has to offer. If reality is not offering that, then that cannot be your satisfaction. It will never. You can't be satisfied because it's not offering that. So therefore, the rich man, which we mean that he's satisfying himself, he looks at reality, and he looks at the consequences. So he knows the only way he can satisfy himself is by listening to what the consequences are. That should help him make the decision. So he could satisfy himself. You understand? But the other one gets immediate satisfaction, maybe. But it's not real because the physical world doesn't have to offer what he's saying. Methodologically, in other words, we had no in except from the first half. From the second half. Then from the second half, that helped us understand the first half. Then because of the questions on the first half, like why is one half a metaphor and the other half not a metaphor, so that helped us change the definition. So the first half, help us change the analysis of the second half. Right? That's how we went back and forth. And in that way, all the questions are answered. In other words, what Matt wants to say, that what about, well, he might get satisfaction from his thoughts, which is a true thing. In other words, let's say he works out that there's a certain desire that he has, and then he works out that that desire, the physical world, will not satisfy. So he's happy because he enjoyed the thoughts. And King Solomon is not saying that. I'm not saying that's not a true statement. I mean, and that's a very high level already where a person loves learning. And learning could satisfy him over the physical world. We're talking about a beginner. Beginner that's still attached to the physical world. So we're talking about satisfaction in the physical world. From the physical world. Not from within yourself. That's a further development of the human being. And King Solomon is not talking about that. He's talking about the first step. But he's still looking for satisfaction in the physical world itself. So from the satisfaction in the physical world could only be is where you accept from the physical world that which is real. But if you fantasize about the physical world and you think something is real when it's not, then you can never be satisfied. Okay, we're chapter 13, verse 9. It says, and it says, the light of the righteous will rejoice, and the candle of the wicked will go out. So the question is, what is the light? What is the candle? And both sides, both predicates go to the happy goes to the light, and the going out goes to the candle. So that works out well. The question is, what is the light and what is the candle? And how does light? And how does the light be happy? Yeah, how's the light happiness? Laura wants to say that the light is like a guide, guides the way. Light, is that what you want to say? In other words, it makes you see things better. Okay, light makes you see things better. Right, so the question is, how is that which makes you see things better happy? Right, that's one approach. The second approach is go from the happiness side. Since the happiness attaches to the light, then happiness usually is where the object is perfected. In other words, happiness comes about where there is no conflict. That's basically what happiness is, no conflict, and the soul is perfected. Now, here we're saying somehow that the light, whatever the light is perfected. Okay? So that's the second approach, but again, we don't know what, in this case, we don't know what the light is. The first approach, we know what the light is, we don't know what the happiness is. The second approach, we know the happiness, we don't know what the light is. The other question is that the two sides of the whole verse is not opposites. In other words, if you take the opposite of going out, that the light goes out, then the other is that either the light goes on or the light will continue, it won't go out. And if you take the happiness, then the other side should be unhappiness, not going out. And the other question is that one side is light and one side is a candle. Is it just giving two different metaphors for the same idea? Sometimes they change, just use the same with two different aspects. But it really means one thing. Or is it literal that one is just talking about the light without the candle, and one is talking about a candle that has a light? We're trying another approach. And that approach is that ideas are not physical. Therefore, the light without a candle is like it's impossible physically. But yet metaphorically it represents something which is not physical, okay? Namely ideas. Ideas is the opposite of the physical, okay? So therefore the light would be the ideas of the righteous will make it happy. Okay. Ideas are a part of the soul. In other words, In other words, the five senses does not have anything in it. It only perceives the physical. But however, Torah holds that the mind is not empty and just perceives like the five senses. It has ideas in it. It has ideas. In other words, there's a difference of opinion among the philosophers what ideas it has. Some people hold that it's just the categories, like categories of Aristotle, and some people hold that it's also mathematics too. Okay, they have mathematical, abstract the mathematical ideas, a little more particular. Okay, difference of opinion, fine. But the thing is that is the soul, because it can't be the physical part of you, since this is not a physical thing, you see? So therefore, this is the soul. The soul has the ideas, and therefore it will satisfy the soul when it has ideas. And the tzaddik, who works on ideas and always clarifying ideas, his soul will be satisfied. Okay, Laura and Matt want to say that the word satisfaction is not good, because satisfaction means that you had your satisfaction, it's over. But the metaphor is happiness. Happiness could be an ongoing thing. And so therefore the ideas, the world of ideas, are constantly making you happy. It's a continuous act of happiness. The ideas are a continuous act of happiness. Now, another question is, what's the other side? The candle of the wicked goes out. Right. So we want to say that the candle is the conduit to the light, meaning that the physical body, in the world, you have the physical body, and then that's the conduit to the mind. But if the candle is the essence, where the candle is the essence, where the physical life is the essence, then that part of you, the thinking part of you that is connected to the soul, that part of you will go out. In other words, the world of ideas will be closed to it. Will be closed. The light goes out. It's closed because it's totally involved with the physical. The subject, the question is, what is the subject of the pasuk, and what are the two opposites? Subject is the soul, and the subject is the soul, and the question is that the soul. A person when he comes into this life, he has a soul. And now there are two things what he could do. Either he could relate to the world of ideas, or he could relate to the physical. If he relates to the world of ideas, so then the soul will be satisfied. The person as a whole will be satisfied. There will be an ongoing act of satisfaction. While the person that gets involved in the physical, in his lifestyle of the physical, so then that person, that part of him, the part, the thought, and the soul part of him is totally closed off, and it totally goes out. So, like it's closed. He totally closes it off and doesn't allow it to operate. Alright, we're doing verse 10. It says, only with zodon. Zodon means on purpose. When you do an evil thing like on purpose, it gives quarrels, and with advisors is wisdom. I realize it doesn't make too much sense, but it says rock means only bezadon. Zadon means on purpose. When you do it to evil on purpose, it gives quarrels. The Mitzvah Tzion translates matzah as quarrels, and the word es could sometimes be with. And with advisors, that's plural, no, what's in it? With advisors, chachmah is wisdom. So, of course, the first half and the second half have absolutely nothing to do with each other. And the last half, I understand. With advisors, there's wisdom. But what is the first thing they're talking about? And also, sometimes quarrels come about by misunderstanding, not by on purpose. the two people, sometimes the Quran come out by using, each one is using the same term, but they understand it differently, and it comes out a whole different disagreement. But, the question is, what is, how could it be? That only on purpose, it says, only on purpose, it gives quarrels. What does it mean, it gives? Makes quarrels, unless that's what it means. Maybe that's what it means, it makes quarrels. Causes quarrels. We're going to start with the second half, because that seems to make sense. And that is like this. Whenever you think through something, you must have all the possibilities so that you could know which possibilities to use. If you don't have all the possibilities, so you might not know the correct possibility yet. So therefore, you might choose a possibility that really there's a third possibility. Let's say you have two possibilities and you make a decision between the two possibilities, when in reality there's a third possibility, a fourth possibility. Two is, even if one of the advisors that you talk over give the incorrect possibility, you understand why it's the incorrect possibility, then you could, that could guide you towards the correct possibility. So therefore, where there's many different people gathering together to talk together, that causes you wisdom. It causes you to have knowledge and how to make a decision in a given situation. In the first half, we have Matt has a question like this. Sometimes there's I have a intent. I plan out a quarrel. I start a quarrel. Plan it out. I want to start a quarrel. Or sometimes a person unconsciously wants to start a quarrel, you see, but it's not consciously. Like for instance, sometimes, like we said before in the example, like sometimes the two people are using the same word in a different way, right? Now, so it comes out they have two different views, right? So therefore, what should you do? You should analyze the two views, is that correct? But however, one gets angry with the other, you see? He's not intentionally getting angry. I mean, it's an unconscious intention. And unconsciously, he's really getting angry. You see, and it causes anger, you see? So the question is, which type of anger are we talking about? That's the question. And I think that's the answer. The answer is that the subject matter is that anger, and that which causes quarrels, what really is the cause of quarrels is where you close off other possibilities. That's the cause of quarrels. That's why the second half now works out very well. The second half is saying that with many possibilities that you get wisdom. But however, when you get angry, whether it's conscious or unconscious, in other words, the purpose, why it's called on purpose, that you're getting angry on purpose, is because that you refuse to see any other possibility but your own. You can't see another possibility. That is the cause of arguments. That's what the pasuk is saying. It's an interesting aspect of, usually we talk about certain emotions, certain things, you know what I mean, that cause arguments, you know. But here it's pointing to one aspect that must always be true. I cannot open my mind to any other possibility but my own. That causes a quarrel. That's very true. That's really true. Insofar as the methodology is concerned, it's always better to take that which you understand first. And once you get that, that could lead to the answer. Okay? Once again, we're clarifying the first half. It says, only with Zadon. Zadon means intentional. Intentionally, you want a quarrel. It causes quarrels. Intentional, the zadon, on purpose, you cause quarrels, okay? Now, what is the cause of the quarrel? It doesn't say. It just says that somehow you want to start a quarrel, but it doesn't say what you want. So from this half of the pasuk, we don't know what the component is which causes the quarrel. What we do is get it from the second half, where the second half says that with many advisors, which means many possibilities, you get chachma, you work it through. It doesn't mean that you have to accept what the other person says, but you have to investigate what the other person says to see maybe it's true, maybe it's not true. That is chachma. But once you close your mind to possibilities, that is the start of a quarrel. That is the zodon. That is the that you're